Well, folks, it's that time of year again, when the snow falls and the sleigh bells ring and the what the hell am I going to get Uncle Stan and Aunt Betty for Christmas anxiety seeps in. Well, have no fear, because Off Camera is here to help you with your gift-giving needs. Just go to offcamera.com, click on the store, and you will find all of our fabulous Off Camera magazine subscription deals. Not only will you be able to give the most unique and interesting Christmas gift, but you will also be helping support the show, while not supporting some giant corporation. It's a win-win-win. So this Christmas, class up your friends and relatives' coffee tables with some real culture by giving them the limited edition Off-Camera magazine. Merry Christmas, or Happy Hanukkah, or Happy Kwanzaa, or Happy Apocalypse, whatever you celebrate or believe in. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor, writer, director, and rapper Riz Ahmed. If you only know Riz Ahmed from his recent starring role in HBO's The Night Of, consider yourself lucky. You've got some of the best movie watching of your life ahead of you. Before HBO brought him to wide attention, he was piling up work and critical acclaim in films like The Road to Guantanamo, Four Lions, and The Reluctant Fundamentalist. The funny, or maybe scary, thing is how close he came to not being an actor at all. To a UK-born son of Pakistani immigrants who struggled to find his place in a posh high school and then Oxford, breaking into show business didn't seem likely. How could it when he saw so few people like himself on screen? Luckily, fate intervened. Odd how that always seems to happen when extreme talent is involved. Though he's now likely to be seen by a much wider audience, assuming at least a few people will see the new Star Wars movie, Riz still approaches his work as though no one will be paying attention. It lets him stay true to his own personal experience of the world, which in the end is the best way to connect with it. Riz told me that if his work can stretch the boundaries of empathy in our ever more binary world, that's his holy grail. In this conversation, we talk about the three worlds he grew up in and how they informed his work. You'll also learn about his alter ego, Riz MC, and his seeming fondness for orange jumpsuits. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Riz.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, thanks for coming and doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, I don't even know where to start with you because you do so many things. And I first heard of you and saw you in Nightcrawler, but in digging through your career and your history a little bit for this, and also becoming just glued to Night Of when it came out, I realized, like, you've got this whole other side of you. You're a musician, you direct, you write, and I don't even want to start in on your political and your philosophical background because I'll just be out of my depth immediately. So it's intimidating and wonderful to have you here.
Look, I'm a big fan of the show, like I was telling you. I kind of think it's strange that you know, a lot of the time you train at drama school in the UK, and then after that you don't really have a peer group or a community of actors to stay connected to. Whereas I think in the US it's more common for people to stay in classes and stay connected to a community of actors. So this show has actually, you know, weirdly been a resource for me to kind of go and watch and listen to actors talk about their process and their insecurities. And
that's, you know, good. I should charge a fee.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, okay, so that's interesting though, because I think, you know, growing up as a photographer and a director, I definitely felt that isolation of, and still feel it, of wondering how other people go about their work and what their process is. And, you know, my secret fantasy is always to sort of shadow my heroes and to watch what they do to see what I'm missing, you know, whether it's directors or photographers or whatever, whoever. And, you know, speaking of Nightcrawler and how I first became aware of you, you got to sit next to, literally, for the whole shoot of that movie, you got to sit next to Jake Gyllenhaal and watch his process.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, Jake is just really, really dedicated, as you know. You know, you've seen the transformation he likes to go through physically sometimes, and just how dedicated he is, how much he cares about his work. And it was interesting because we started rehearsing about a month beforehand. I thought, let me get out there early, do a lot of research about kind of homelessness in LA and that whole thing. Skid Row is its own world, and I thought maybe that character Rick you know, has been homeless for a while.
Yeah.
And the way we'd rehearse is really interesting. I would be kind of very much from the British approach, just kind of analyzing the text. So we'd be sat at the table, I'd be going, no, but look, you know, on this line I say this, so surely that means I'm saying it for this reason, or doing, you know, detective work on the text, which he does as well. But it's interesting that his process was kind of like starving himself.
Right, right. He would, and ride his bike to set, right? And
yeah.
While and starving.
Run home after like a night shoot and just, he would have like a cup of tea and a chewing gum.
Well, what was it? What did that sort of tell you, or what did you sort of draw from that?
I think it was a kind of just a different way of working that's more kind of visceral, you know, whether you call it method or whatever, kind of just a bit more physically immersive. And, you know, there's that old anecdote of, is it Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier when they were on Marathon Man? And Dustin Hoffman was like running up and down on the film set, you know, trying to make himself out of breath for the scene. And he says, what are you doing? He's like, I've got to be tired in this scene. He goes, you should try something, darling. It's called acting. And so it's interesting, that difference of kind of approach. You know, I kind of questioned why he was doing that and what that had to do with anything. You know, there was nowhere in the text. There were no signposts for him to be emaciated or anything.
Right.
But I guess it just boils down to something as simple as his character was desperately hungry. And so he decided to be desperately hungry. And there's just something very immediate and physical about that kind of approach that... they influenced me a little bit when I went into The Night Of, actually, you know, just kind of working in a kind of quite an immersive way, and particularly with the kind of physical transformation. So yeah, it was interesting. I definitely learned a lot from that experience, both about how I like to work and ways in which I haven't tried to work yet.
Right. Well, I think that there's as many actors as there are, there's as many approaches too.
Right.
But I would think, to your point of not staying in touch and having a community of actors, I think, if nothing else, it gives you confidence that there's a bunch of different ways to get to a solution.
Yeah, and also gives you confidence that everyone screws up.
Right.
You know, because, I mean, what you sometimes end up seeing is you see the pristine, edited, spit-shined performance that's presented to you, you know, after take 10, after the reshoots, after the amazing editors have come in, after the ADR. And it sometimes can just be really, really reassuring to know that other people forget their lines and other people screw up and other people beat themselves up afterwards. And I think it kind of takes a real bravery, actually, to kind of just let go and allow yourself to make mistakes.
Was there a time when you said, okay, I'm going to loosen the reins a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I remember when I was doing Black Gold with... Jean-Jacques Hano and Taha Rahim. There was this scene where Taha Rahim's character, my brother, gets shot, and I kind of jump off my camel, and as you do, and the stage direction says, you know, Ali, my character, wails uncontrollably. And I don't normally kind of pay massive attention to stage direction. Sometimes, you know, I think take it more as a suggestion. And I just thought, you know, I don't really wail uncontrollably that much. Let me try and go for that. And really kind of just, you know, spent that whole morning keeping myself in this zone, this kind of emotional incubator of sadness, which is not really how I like to work. I like to try and just be kind of quite relaxed rather than holding on to a feeling. You know, sometimes it can get too marinated.
Right.
You know, and just went in and just let go and was just screaming and bawling in my eyes out and crying my eyes out for this scene. And this scene just kind of went on for about, you know, a minute. And then there was like a cut. And it was a bit quiet. And Jean-Jacques Hano comes over and goes, okay, I think maybe a bit less, a little bit less. And yeah, it was terrible. I mean, it was absolutely awful. It was god awful. Like, went back and watched it and was like, okay, cool. That's why I don't work like that. But I'm glad I tried it. And, you know, sometimes it takes balls just to just try a new way of working there and then on set, you know, just to kind of see what comes up. And there's a real kind of loss of control that comes with being an actor, because you kind of, you set the buffet out. Hopefully you kind of provide your director with a bunch of different options, and you really can't tell what they're going to choose. I mean, the most extreme example of that, I would say, is working with Michael Winterbottom, uh-huh. who I did my very first film with.
And Trishna too, with. Yeah.
And so the way Michael would work is completely improvised, no script, very chilled out, very quite hands-off as a director. And he might be directing you to do absolutely insane things. He'd be like, okay, so just gonna like step up to her and just like take the knife out, just like stab her in the gut. Okay, action. You're like, So if you want me to step up to her and stab her in the guts, okay, cool.
And that's the first you're hearing of it.
Yeah. It's very chill. The days are very short. It's very relaxed. It's like kind of going on a holiday with buddies, you know. Creates a very relaxed atmosphere on set and has you doing absolutely crazy shit.
Yeah.
You know, based off his just relaxed vibe. You know, okay, he's going to like take a shit in the bucket and then throw up into the same bucket action. It's like, what? And there's no script and you're just kind of improvising stuff. But so what you end up doing is you do this version of the scene, this version of the scene, this version of the scene, this version of the movie, this version. And he in the edit will plot your journey and your graph. So it sometimes feels like really weird. You're like, it's almost like you've been edited out of context. It's like, oh shit. Like you're literally just spraying out your guts. And he picks and chooses and he'll find the story within that. So for example, in Trishna, the whole third act was kind of turned on its head.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, my character became a completely different person in the third act, which, you know, to be fair, he called me up and said, this is why I have to do this. We need sympathy for her.
And we should say that it's based upon a book.
Well, yeah, it's really ambitious, actually. It's kind of based upon Tess of the D'Urbervilles by
right.
Thomas Hardy. So it's an improvised adaptation of Tess of the D'Urbervilles set in modern India. And my character is actually a combination of two characters from the original novel.
Right. In the movie, you play the son of a wealthy hotel operator, and you fall in love with a girl working at a hotel who's very poor, played
yes.
by Frida Pinto.
Yes, exactly.
And the two of you fall in love. And
yeah, but the kind of like underlying power imbalance
yes.
in the relationship comes to the fore, particularly as frustrations start kind of striking both their lives. Things start fracturing a little bit, and you start seeing a quite unhealthy power balance emerge and really consolidate itself in an abusive way. But it can be really weird. It's like, that is my performance, but it's also not my performance,
right.
you know? So that's both kind of liberating and kind of like scary and a bit disempowering, but also kind of gives you a sense of perspective of like, really that is what you're doing. You're putting some fuel in the tank. It's up to the director where he drives a car.
Well, it definitely, you have to trust your director, right?
Yeah.
And if you don't, that's not the film you should be doing.
Yes, because then you're not going to feel safe enough to like go out there and make mistakes and say, I'm going to, you know, set the whole buffet out and trust you to pick the best bits.
Right.
But for in the third act of Trishna, I mean, my character was, for example, there are scenes where, you know, I'm making love to her and she's visibly upset. And when we did the scenes, she's, you know, crying, and my character carries on for a bit and then stops and goes, you know, baby, are you okay? Are you all right? But of course, in the edit, they were like, you know, by the third act, we have to really sympathize with her.
Yeah.
So
isn't that funny?
I just carry on.
So you shot,
we
could be
like
a totally different story
movies.
Taken out of that.
Yeah, exactly. Which is kind of, you know, a credit to his genius as well in terms of like, you know, finding the story he wants to tell within your performance. So yeah, I don't know, kind of like having the comfort level to screw up, to like let yourself screw up is, yeah, I think it's really important. And sometimes that can come from just a sense of playfulness.
Right.
You know, creating a sense of play on set. When I did Four Lions, I don't think I ever laughed as much on a film set. You know, Chris Morris, who's a kind of American viewers might not be as familiar with his work, but he's kind of like.
And Chris made Four Lions,
yes.
which you play. It's a farce about terrorism.
Yeah. It's about a bunch of guys that want to be terrorists, but they're just really bad at it.
Right.
Basically. and so kind of really subversive in the sense that it humanizes them, both terrifying and endearing. You know, it's much easier to go, oh, these people are evil, they're just demonic. And it's much harder to go, I kind of recognize myself in that person.
Yeah.
Which I think is the kind of basis for all acting. Like, you've got to believe that on some fundamental level we're the same, right? It's just a set of contingencies and circumstances
right.
that mean you're in that chair and I'm in this chair. And if you don't believe that, then how can you play another character that isn't you?
Exactly.
Or how can you relate to a character whose life isn't the same as yours? So that film just kind of takes that premise and just takes it to an extreme and goes, You know the ultimate bogeyman in our culture? Why don't we put you in their shoes for a minute?
Right.
And roll with them. So it's, for a control freak like me, acting is often just a process of like kind of abandoning control, which is why I can find it quite a, quite a tricky experience at times, you know? I'm definitely that person that goes home and like, be running the, you know, last week's lines in the mirror at 4 a.m.
You can ruminate over it and question it and look at it and critique it. And
you know, some of my best friends say, like, you know, my favorite game is like, look, this is how I did it, but this is how I should have done it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. It's like, dude, we're eating. Shut the fuck up. We don't need to know about this right now.
So, well, that brings up a question of how you watch your own performances, or if you do. Like, did you have to come to terms with watching your performances and accepting
Yeah, I
them?
Think that's something that you get better at over time. You know, I remember when I was first watched my first performances, you kind of fixate on things in a way that no viewer will. They're watching the story as a whole. You're a piece in that story. When you're watching yourself, you're fixating on, like, what you... you know, how much you were blinking, or stuff that people no one notices. But as you get better at that, I found it has become a great tool. And often I really like to go and, you know, after done a few takes, go and watch playback.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. Just because there might be little things that I notice technically, or it's just easier for me to watch than it is to try and... It's kind of, I think, I like to think it helps the director out, because they don't have to kind of sit and think of a really sensitive way of, like, telling you to, like... you know, look less dumb. You know what I mean? And you just like, oh, okay, yeah, I got it. You know, let me go back in, which can be helpful.
Right. They would probably say, look a little more smart.
Look less dumb. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Isn't that funny? I think that a lot of directing for a lot of actors is like identifying what each person needs. And you're right. I suppose the more confident you get in yourself and the more able you are to interpret your own performance within the story, the less you sort of need that kind of thing from a director.
Yeah, but I still do think that your best work is when you kind of put yourself completely in the hands of a director that you kind of sync up with.
Yeah.
And, you know, I it's a strange one. I kind of feel like every time you're rewriting the rule book, you know, you're kind of tearing up your old lessons, and every job is different to the last because of the alchemy of the kind of involved with the different people on set, or the actors, or the director, the material, the nature of it, the way they're shooting it. For example, you know, something like Four Lions was shot handheld, you know, completely kind of performance first, no marks that we had to hit and come and stand to get into lights, hardly lit. And, you know, Chris Morris is kind of like the Kaiser Soze of British comedy, is how I describe him. He's like this mythic figure almost, who hardly ever does interviews and is worshipped. As, you know, he kind of, he's been kind of banned from radio, he's been banned from television, he's been called the most hated man in Britain, and he's probably like just, you know, he's a kind of cult hero. And he always does kind of very controversial stuff, you know, like slapstick comedy about lovable suicide bombers, for example. And so his whole vibe would be like, we're gonna mess around, you know, obviously, granted, it's a comedy, so... But because of the tone, because of the vibe of the film and the material, you know, he'd just be off camera and we'd be doing lines and be like, you know, call him a camel's dick. It's like, okay, you try that. Whereas obviously, you know, the night of, it was, if you see it so kind of visually so precise.
Yes.
And Steve Zaillian has such a distinct vision that it was very much, often it was like ballet. You know, it was very, very technical. I mean, you try and shoot a wide shot of someone through prison bars, you literally have to make sure your eyes are
right.
Like...
I noticed that watching it, that there's a
very,
lot of times where...
It's very precise, and so you're kind of going to take 15 going, ah, oh, no, I'm off, wait. Yeah, okay, got it there, you know. So the process is kind of different. You have to find, you know, different ways into the material and different process every time. So that's why I guess that's why I love it. You always feel like you're a beginner.
It's different than most any other job, right? When you're working in a collaborative creative field, there is a new set of parameters each time you start a new project.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't agree more. And the lesson that I keep learning more and more is that these things are ultimately out of your control. You can set the right conditions. You know, I kind of think like we're like walking chemistry sets. You know, is that advice that Al Pacino gave Hilary Swank on the set of Insomnia? It was like, have you got any acting advice? And he was like, stay away from craft services, you know. It's true, like we're walking chemistry sets, you know, that sugar rush is not helpful before you're going into a close-up, or the sugar crash if they come to you second. And it's so much of what we do is about managing this chemistry set, setting the right kind of parameters, you know, tuning up the pinball machine in the right way, and you drop that pinball in, you don't really have... And you can't tell which way it's going to go. And that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
Which is why this idea of like having a GPS in your performance, like, okay, this scene I want to end up here, this scene I want to... I kind of feel like that's... I'm sure you can come up with some really beautifully crafted performances on that, but this sometimes might lack the kind of madness and the magic of losing control. And that idea of not really having control over what those ingredients are in the chemistry set of a film crew always surprises me. One thing I keep noticing is how the dynamics on and off set end up mirroring each other.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So me and Jake for Nightcrawler, we come in, get to know each other. You know, it's polite, sweet. You know, he's asking about me, just like he's asking about Rick, for example. Right? You spend like 6 weeks on just night shoots with someone, you can end up snapping each other.
Yeah, I bet.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? It's fine. It's great. And before you know it, it's like I'm kind of on this kind of like, really kind of like, well, I guess he does take care of me. He's kind of like a big brother and he's a pal. He doesn't mean anything by it. And he's on this kind of like, Riz, I've told you once before, you know, it's like, it's happening. Or with John Turturro, you know, in The Night Of, inevitably this guy starts taking me under his wing, you know. I'm just drawn to him. I feel he understands me somehow. He's kind of fighting my corner at times, you know, defending.
On set.
Yeah.
On set.
Right. Yeah. He's suddenly my defender at times amongst the like madness of a massive film set. I'm used to doing like tiny British indie films. I'm like, shit, like how do I find my space? Like this is how you find, no, he needs some, you know.
Do you think that was conscious on his part?
No. This stuff happens. It always just weirdly ends up happening.
So do you think there's crossover, like you take on that person's life and there's enough detail about it that it spills over?
Yeah, I find that happens most effectively when you put the less deliberately you try and do it or arrive at the result of embodiment.
Less control.
Yes, kind of like input, focusing on the inputs rather than the outputs. So I always think that kind of character isn't a way of behaving, it's a way of seeing. If you see things in a certain way, if I see you as a threat, the behavior will follow suit. Again, I can't like focus on the output or the end result. Otherwise, I'm kind of managing something that's mannered and planned. And so for me, something that I find really, really important is just trying to fill my head with the thoughts that character might have until hopefully you get to that point where like you're seeing things a little differently. Like when we were on set for Nightcrawler and like we're shooting these nights in these like kind of slightly weird neighborhoods in LA, kind of going from, you see a kind of shopping trolley with some kind of, you know, plastic bags in it, maybe someone, you know, who's homeless has left some stuff in it, from going like, well, shit, maybe I'll take a step away from that, to kind of going like, you know, I don't know, just feeling, you know, I've spent enough time on Skid Row and stuff to know, like, oh, sometimes people leave, like, valuables. I don't know, just you take a step towards it, just inside. I'm not saying I'm, like, robbing homeless people or a Nightcrawler. But you just have that kind of a certain impulse. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman said to play a character is to be able to defend them, just to see things the way they see them as much as possible. And you're always going to go in and out. But if you... I mean, it's as simple as going, okay, me as Riz turn up in New York and I see a yellow taxi cab and I'm like, oh, yeah, the opening credits of Friends, right? That's not what I should be thinking when I see a yellow taxi cab as Nas in The Night Of. I should be thinking, oh, man, I wonder how long Dad's had to work today, for example. And of course, you never fully go, I mean... I'm not the guy that goes around in character 24/7, but it's just about allowing your environment to trigger a different set of reactions in your chemistry set, you know, if you tune it the right way. So that's why I kind of think it's all about, you know, finding the right way of seeing, kind of tuning things, the right associations with the right ingredients. But then when you get there, you don't know what the reaction's going to be.
But that is every bit as valuable as, you say, studying the text.
Yeah, well, I mean, ideally, in an ideal world, if you have enough time to prepare, then I would love to try and do both. But I kind of always see the text as like the tip of the iceberg. So my job is to like find those icebergs, you know, underneath it. But that's something that's, you know, really like something that I've had to come to terms with as well now, is like having less time to prepare. You know, sometimes when you go from job to job,
yeah,
having less prep time.
The problem of success.
Very new and short-lived for me, I'm sure. But it's like this idea
I don't think
of like,
short-lived.
Well, this idea of kind of like, okay, so if you like to do five things, that's great, very nice, good boy. Yeah, you get to do one.
Yeah, how do you compress all the work that you've done before into a shorter amount of time and not feel like you've cheated it? Like, how do you keep your confidence?
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I have cheated, you know? Sometimes I feel like I don't feel as confident. And sometimes I feel like maybe if I've been doing it for a bit longer, maybe like I can go through the steps quicker. Sometimes. So that's, I don't know. I don't really know how to deal with that, to be honest. I think that you're forced to trust your gut a little more, I think. You know, I remember I saw an interview with Tom Hardy talking about The Revenant, and he said, look, I'll be honest, and someone asked him, where did that accent come from? How did you research? He was like, well, I kind of like Platoon, the movie, but I got to be honest, I was a little bit naughty. I came straight off another film, like traveled the day after I rapped and was at the top of a mountain shooting. So I just had to kind of go with it.
Right.
And that presents a whole different set of, you know,
you gotta
challenges
have balls to do
and
it
stuff. Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Well, The Night Of is, I mean, I would set it up, but I think everyone's seen it. It's amazing in this day and age of amazing television everywhere that a show could come out that's 8 episodes long that everybody's talking about.
And yeah.
And I think that one of the great appealing things about The Night Of is that there was so little dialogue in the first few episodes from you, and yet I think I speak for the audience when I say that I knew exactly what you were thinking and feeling. And yet I've never been to jail, and I've never, you know, been roofied, and I've never, you know, any of those things.
There's still time, yeah.
But did you think about that going in? Like in terms,
I
guess,
you know, I've got to be honest, like the success of The Night Of is stunning to me. Because of the process of getting it made, which was really fraught and was a roller coaster. And to be honest, I just thought it was never going to get made. So we shot the pilot in 2012.
Right.
So when I watch that, it's like watching a different person.
Do you have a desire to reshoot the pilot?
Oh, I have a desire to reshoot everything. Yeah. Me and Steve Zalian is a dangerous combination of like, kind of like, let's redo it. Guys, we're on take 40. It's like, it's okay, we'll redo it. You know, he kind of gave me this incredible opportunity, which I'm so grateful for. And we shot the pilot in 2012. And we were like, okay, I think it went well. Apparently they'll pick it up. And they didn't pick it up. They didn't pick up the pilot.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that was it. We weren't gonna do it. Then like months later, which is heartbreaking, months later, they pick it up. And we're like, okay, cool, we're gonna do it. A month after that, James Gandolfini passed away, who originally played John Stone in the pilot. So then that was it, the project was over. And then months later, maybe almost coming up to a year, it was back on, and Robert De Niro was gonna do it. And then they got the scripts all ready. And then he stepped away. And then it was like, well, this is over. Everyone was
now
like,
now it's really over.
It's over,
yeah.
We're done with it. And then I think Steve Zalian said, you know who I always actually kind of wrote the role for, who I had in my head when I was writing, was John Turturro. Why don't we ask him? We've got the scripts ready. Let's see if... And then it was like, get to New York next week. You know, we're doing that thing that you did 2.5 years ago that's broken your heart 6 times, you thought you're never going to do. You've probably had too much time to think about and too much time away from, and we're doing it now. And so I've never had such a kind of build-up to a job before. I've never had so much time to overthink and over-prepare, but also be caught by surprise so much by a job.
Right.
And so when we stepped into it, we were already like, this is that cursed thing. This is the thing with the curse on it that's never getting made. And the shoot was really challenging. You know, it was like in the middle of a superstorm, filming up in Yonkers in a prison, emotionally quite heavy.
A real prison?
Often, yeah, in Queens Detention Center and the Tombs in downtown Manhattan. So the combination of all that was, and then, you know, Steve is just an uncompromising perfectionist. It's kind of incredible. I've never seen anything like it, you know. And so that means when he felt he needed to take the time, we did. So we went over by a little bit. But thank God we did, because we got all we needed to. And
right.
He didn't want to compromise. He didn't want to cut episode 7. And so we're like, this is the thing that's never getting made. And as we're making it, we're like, this is the thing that's going to kill us if it gets made. And by the time we finish it, we're like, this is the thing that if it had come out in 2012, there wouldn't be so much amazing TV around. And now, like 2016, if it comes out, we're going to be lost in the mix.
It's just another show about
it's
a real
crime. It's just another
and...
like great show in a world of incredible shows that everyone is behind on watching. You know, I still haven't seen Breaking Bad. So the fact that we actually made it, we finished it, it didn't kill us, and it's reached an audience amongst all this amazing TV, it's almost comical to me.
Yeah, I mean, when something hits the zeitgeist in such a way, there is no way to prepare for it or to understand it. You just sort of say, great, that was my time when that happened, right?
Well, it's funny as well, because I think if the show had come out in 2013 before the Donald Trump era, before the kind of real focus on the Black Lives Matter movement and conversations about, you know, prison industrial complex and policing of ethnic minorities, I don't think it would have kind of reached as big an audience. And it's not like you're hoping that all those things will start going badly in our society so your show does better. But it's weird that, yeah, the timing, it just made it kind of quite resonant
as
regards to a lot of the conversations we're having in our society right now. So it's funny how things work out. It's really weird.
It is, and to think of you being in the center of that, and it is really a moment in terms of not only the things you discussed, the Black Lives Matter and some of the things with the political climate, but also in Hollywood and in filmmaking itself, and the focus on diversity and on real diversity, and like it all sort of happened. It's sort of at the crescendo of all of those conversations.
Yeah, I hope it's the crescendo of that conversation, but often it feels like we're still kind of the very early stages of even talking about or addressing some of these problems.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I if any of the work that any of us do, like, contributes incrementally to stretching culture or stretching the boundaries of empathy that can be expected or should be expected of an audience in relating to different kinds of characters, then that's like, I mean, that's the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
You know, to me, I mean, stories are about empathy. And it's like, I just think culture is this space where we can put ourselves in someone else's shoes. So it just makes sense to have as many different kinds of pairs of shoes for people to try on and experience and relate to, because really, we're complicated people. We're all mongrels in one way or another. But the world we live in forces us into these binaries. You're either this kind of guy or that kind of girl. You know, it's... and for me, you know, code switching was just a day-to-day thing. It's almost like probably why I'm an actor. You know, in the course of one day, I was in a, you know, working-class Pakistani household, child of immigrants, to a kind of posh, predominantly white school where I had kind of got a scholarship to attend, which is like an hour and a half away from my house. And... you know, when they were playing rugby and stuff that I just did not relate to, and doing like the whole like, we're going to march around in army uniforms and stuff, I would skip class and go and hang out with my friends that would attend schools and colleges close to where I grew up. So there were kind of three quite distinct cultures between, like, you know, this private school, traditional household, and kind of Brit-Asian street culture, I guess
right.
You could say. And pinballing between those has really kind of defined my adolescence. And navigating those kind of taught me more about inhabiting a role than probably, you know, anything ever could.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about, like, growing up, because you're a second-generation immigrant. I mean, I would think you'd feel like a bit of an outsider no matter where you were because of that.
Well, I guess, like, everyone's experience is a default experience to them.
Sure.
There's nothing, you know, it's just...
You don't have anything to compare it to.
Right, it's only when that conversation is dropped on your doorstep of like, yo, what are you? Choose.
Right.
Choose, are you this or are you this? Or if you leave an environment where many other people can relate to that mongrelhood and people are like, yo, you're a mongrel. That's when you become, you know, very kind of self-aware.
Do you remember a specific time when you made the connection that you're... often defined as an outsider? Like, do you remember when it went from, oh, this is my neighborhood, to...
I mean, look, I don't want to kind of make out like I've kind of had some miserable life or whatever, but I think many people who've grown up outside of what is deemed as like the default of either you know, class or ethnic or sexual identity, feel that really pretty much from the go.
Right.
Like, you know, whether you suffer kind of like violence in your childhood, you know, driven by hate crimes, or you know, brush up against the police, or going to, you know, going to a school that's kind of generally populated by a different class, social class of people, and kind of being really made aware of that. I mean, I remember, well, not to get, so I don't want to dwell too much on the really like, on the darkness or the violence and stuff.
No.
But there's, but maybe like a funnier example is when I went to Oxford University, which was like another kind of big step away from that environment. It was like, I remember the first person's door that I knocked on was my neighbor's, and I'd left my like phone charger at home. And there was like people walking around in bow ties and bow, like straw hats. I was like, I did not get this memo about fancy dress. And I knocked on this person's door and said, I'm terribly sorry, you know, trying to be well-spoken. Would you mind if I could borrow your phone charger by any chance? And she laughed in my face and said, oh my God, you remind me so much of Ali G. It's unbelievable. And I was like, this is going to be a ride and a half, you know. But it was that was great for me in a way, because it was an experience of being just like from the get-go being told, you kind of don't belong here. This isn't kind of for, this kind of isn't for you. And that was great because it was such great training for the film industry.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, about how that sort of outsider status kind of creates a person who ends up being drawn to performing.
After about a month at Oxford, I kind of, I remember I emailed my tutors and I was like, I'm sorry, I can't do this. You know, I just got quite depressed. I just felt really, I just really couldn't relate in so many ways, in weird little ways, in like, you know, I wasn't equipped socially for that. I just felt such a disconnect.
Did you think when you went to Oxford, things would change, that it would be a different conversation?
I didn't really know what to expect, to be honest.
Yeah.
It just felt like an abstract thing. It's something you're going to aim for. I went there. It was like a big culture shock for me. And I left and I kind of just took the time out and I was like, I'm not going to do this. And then I kind of just thought, why don't I try and like do it kind of on my own terms? And
after
just try.
That
yeah,
email to the tutors.
Yeah. And I was away for like a couple of weeks. And then I came back, and at that time, really what I was doing a lot of was rapping and emceeing on pirate radio stations in London. There was a kind of explosion of you know, UK garage and grime music into the mainstream. And it was like, this thing's happening, and I want to be a part of it, and I've left that in London. So I thought, why don't I set up a club night at Oxford, like a you know, hip-hop drum and bass garage club night. And so I went back and just kind of printed out these really shit posters in the computer room. Like used all my like printing credits, and the only paper there was like green paper, so you hardly even read it. It's just like, you know, hit and run, because it literally, there was a newspaper there, it was like hit and run attack. I was like, that's a cool combination of words. Hit and run, hip hop drum and bass at left the club blank, Wednesday, DJs, like my friends from London. And I just went around to all these nightclubs going, listen, we've got like 500 people coming to this party, like, do you want it to be at your club? Or, and just kind of...
So you totally hustled.
I totally just hustled, thinking, I've got nothing to lose. I'm probably going to leave here anyway. Let me see if I can meet people that are like-minded. Let me see if I can...
Yeah, so what was the impulse for that? Was it to bring the experience to you on
your
own terms?
Yes, and also to try and kind of create some space to breathe and to pursue my creative ambitions and the things I was passionate about. And I remember, like, 10:30 p.m., it was empty, and it was like, oh, it didn't work. And then, like, as is always the way in club promotion, as I realized over the next like decade and a half, is like everyone arrives in that like half hour window, you know. And that's how I kind of paid for my time at university. And so it kind of made me feel like the place where you think you don't belong is the place where you should be. That's the place where you can stretch things. That's the place where you can offer something new. And it can be lonely, and it was at times, and it will be in the future. But that's where you can contribute something different. And that's what got me through, you know, these last 10 years in the film business. And yeah, it was a great lesson.
God, it's so fascinating. So at that time, was acting on your brain at all?
Yeah, to be honest, you know, I quite honestly just didn't think it was feasible as a career at all. And that's partly because of the kind of messaging that you internalize when you look at the cultural landscape, you don't see yourself reflected back in it. You think, like, there's no space for me. Like, what am I going to play? Like, how can I earn a living playing, like, you know, cab driver number three? For, like, how am I going to provide for family? It's like, there's no space for me, man. So I didn't think that there was any chance of
that. But what was the initial impulse, like?
To apply to drama school.
No, even that you liked to act. Like, how did you even know you liked it?
Right. That was, I guess, you know, my mom is, like, a real character. She, like, she's just, like, she's constantly doing these, like, when we were growing up, like, weird, like, voices and characters. And it was, like, part of our game, like, as a little kid. I don't know, it's weird. It's, like, we were just always, it was quite, like, you know, boisterous, loud, loving household I grew up in. And it was, like, you had to kind of, sometimes you, particularly as a little brother, I would kind of find myself having to perform to get attention. But, right. And then so my mom was, like, put me into after-school classes that would happen at the school I was at from, like, the age of eight. And then when I got to high school, I became quite disruptive. And a teacher kind of said, look, if you're going to piss about, do it on stage, you know.
Oh, really?
You're supposed to, yeah.
So a teacher noticed that,
yeah.
that they could channel.
Yeah, a couple of them actually, yeah.
When you say disruptive, what was an example of that?
I just had a temper, I guess. I just had a temper and I would get, like, easily bored, I guess. I don't know, I'd drink a lot of Coca-Cola. Maybe I was, like, sugar sensitive, caffeine sensitive. I was just, like, this hyperactive little bastard that was just always getting thrown out of the classroom and, like, you know, throwing chairs through windows and just kind of being a little nutter. And the teachers kind of said, which I'm so grateful for, you know, teachers like Mr. Green and Mr. Coleman and Mr. Booth and Mr. Roseblade and you know, Mr. Brown, they kind of went over the years at different points when I was getting in, like, increasing different levels of shit, they were like, they pushed me towards that. And I just, it was just magical, man. Like, staying at school after 5:30 p.m.
and to rehearse plays.
And the place is empty. You know, that assembly hall is empty and it's you, you got the run of the place. And, like, the camaraderie of it and the play and the idea that, like, colouring outside of the lines is rewarded. You do something a little bit mad and different and unexpected or
it's
something.
So interesting to hear you say that. And then you go off to Oxford and your thought is there's no way to follow acting because I can't support myself
yeah.
doing it.
Well, Oxford was much more of a culture shock than, you know, it was where I grew up to my high school was like one class jump. Like going to Oxford, that was like another planet, it felt like to me in lots of ways. And I became accustomed to it and I'm grateful for that because, you know, I'm now aware of how to navigate those set of social codes, you
right.
know what I mean? Which is very important in the British film industry, which is generally populated by very upper middle class, you know, people of a certain background. So it was training, really. But at Oxford, I remember when everyone was applying for jobs, you know, lawyers, bankers, whatever, I just couldn't find, I couldn't see myself in a desk job. And my teachers always told me, like, you should be a lawyer or something. And I was like, I don't have the kind of focus, concentration for that, you know? And I remember this girl, Maxine, who I didn't even know very well. It's a black girl at another college, probably one of the only, you know, black girls in my year group, you know, that I knew. Had seen me in a play, Jesus Hop the A-Train, the Stephen Adi Gyrgis play.
Yeah.
And said, look, everyone's applying for these jobs. I hope you're applying to drama school. You should definitely do something with the acting. And that was like one of the, I think that was like the only person, or one of the only people that was like, you should pursue this.
Wow.
And I was like, because I just didn't think there's
didn't
really
even
scope.
Occur to you.
Well, it's just didn't think there's, it's not feasible. Like if you look at the cultural landscape, what roles are you going to play? Where do they put people like me in things? They don't.
That's so sad. I hear that
but,
and it's
but
so
people,
sad.
But people internalize that. And so I thought, oh, screw it, you know what? Like, it's unrealistic, but let me apply to one drama school and just see how it goes. And if I do, I'm gonna do it for 1 year. So I applied to Central School of Speech and Drama. And I remember the audition, they offered me the role there. Rob Clare is amazing.
What did you do for your audition?
I did a speech that really spoke to my feeling about Oxford, which was Edmund's speech from King Lear. Now God, stand up for bastards. You know, these fops got between, you know, sleep and wake that run the show, but actually us bastards, us mongrels, us outsiders that were conceived in the lusty stealth of night, we have an edge even if they kind of see us as dirty. And I did that, and they offered me a role, offered me a space. And so I was like, amazing, but then I couldn't afford it. So then I applied for this, I applied for one scholarship fund, and people generally don't get that. It's the Arts and Humanities Research Board, which they traditionally didn't used to give to, you know, practical courses, more academic focus. But okay, I got that, but I still had a funding gap. And I randomly met this theater producer in the West End who like came and saw me in a play in Oxford and said, darling, I'll take care of you. Thelma Holt, who literally just fairy godmothered me into drama school, said, darling, write a sick-making thank you letter to, you know, Mr. T. Hesketh in Dorset. I was like, what? She's like, here's the extra funds you need. I was like, oh my God. Like, so, you know, so I guess it's important to say, like, yeah, I've had obstacles, but that is like having the red carpet rolled out by life. That is like incredible luck and incredible privilege to have that happen for you. And then I got to go to drama school because of that.
I mean, your story is so, like, you wouldn't have applied to six other drama schools.
No, probably. I wouldn't have. Definitely wouldn't have, no.
It was on the precipice of not happening.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what's sad is that that happens for so many people because they just haven't, that messaging telling them you can do this too, I'm not just talking about acting, I mean, probably don't need more actors, but anything else, they're not receiving that messaging. They're not seeing that implicitly. They're not receiving that messaging. And so they won't give it a second crack or a third or a fourth. That kind of like, yeah, I'm meant to be here. A lot of people don't have that. But you know what? That's true of all kinds of different people as well. Like, I'm sure, you know, Meryl Streep sometimes thinks, shit, I'm about to be found out.
I think that is a common thought with artists, because I also think that if you were a really confident person, you might not pick this.
Yeah, pick a job where you're basically begging everyone to go, well done, well done, well done, well done, good job, standing ovation. You know, it is true. I mean, we must, on some level, I know a lot of performers and artists say they do it for themselves, but on some level, we're seeking validation. On some level, someone gave us the kids laughed at a joke we made in class or something, and it stuck. But the tricky thing is, I think, is that validation-seeking impulse is what totally corrupts any performance. Because it's like...
That's the irony.
Yeah, it's like, you know, when you're on stage doing a play and it's like, if you go looking for the laugh, you ain't getting that laugh.
Right.
It's going to fall flat. I think that is the irony. It's like when you stop chasing that.
Oh, it's amazing when you think of it in those terms that anything gets done. And that anyone gets a role and manages to not totally, like, lock up inside and not... not be able to do it. But you're about to embark on this massive worldwide journey of Star Wars in terms of that being out there. And it's funny, I talked to Ewan McGregor about Star Wars a little bit and about how there's no way he could understand how much that role would change his life. Mm. You know, in terms of traveling the world and being recognized everywhere, and in terms of what a massive machine the movie is.
Right.
I mean, it's the biggest movie franchise on earth. And
yeah.
Did you have a moment where you looked at the idea of Star Wars and the effect it's going to have on your life and sort of examine that in comparison to your independent, community-loving British film-making experience where you're putting your own wire on?
You know, what's really funny is a lot of the same people that I made those British indie films with made Star Wars. The sound man, Stuart Wilson, was the first person who I ever worked with as a sound man on Road to Guantanamo. The guys that did Steadicam and the Focus Puller and the second unit camera person on Daytimer were on Star Wars. It's an interesting thing has happened where, you know, a lot of these big American movies are made in the UK now because of tax breaks, and we've got, you know, I'd like to think, great infrastructure of crew and good talent and stuff, and the studios. So it weirdly felt quite comfortable.
It was like an indie film?
Faces. It's weird, like the way Gareth shot it as well, he would often operate camera.
Really?
Yeah. It has a kind of like slightly kind of boots on the ground, immersive, rough and ready feel to it. So it's obviously the fact you walk in, they've got like imported palm trees from all around the world, and like giant things are exploding, and there's like 1,000 stormtroopers on set. That doesn't feel like an indie film.
Right.
That feels like a theme park. But weirdly had that kind of slightly tactile, rough and ready energy to it. But that's making it. In terms of the effect the film may or may not have, I'm aware of the fact, I'm like, oh, wow, cool. Like, it's a toy.
Like, it's you.
Yeah. But, and you're aware that, like, you know, obviously it's massive and the fans love it. And I feel just, like, really honored to be a part of it. It feels just feels really cool. You know, I grew up watching those films with my brother. You know, some of my earliest memories of like are of Ewoks and, you know, AT-ATs. So it feels really cool. It feels like an honor, but I guess I haven't quite stepped outside of it to go what the effects will be. I'm still kind of enamored with the inside experience of making it, where it's like, you know, there'd be a prop there and you pick it up and it's like, oh my God, they've actually put a touch screen on it and buttons, and there's like, they've animated every...
We spend a lot on these cups.
Yeah, right, exactly. What can I steal? So yeah, I'm still kind of like soaking up the experience of having made it. So
I guess there's no way to imagine how things will change. You just have to go through it.
Yeah, or even if they will change. And also this weird thing where, like, as an actor, lots of people tell you every time you do anything, like, oh, this will, like...
This is the one.
This is the thing that will help you make other things you want to make, or maybe a lot of people will see this. And there's no way of telling. So I know this is different with Star Wars, you know. Generally, these films get watched.
But, I think it watched
but,
a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, but it's you're kind of conditioned to kind of like take that with a pinch of salt, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I'm sure no one was saying that on the night of.
Right, exactly. So you kind of, you don't really believe anyone. You kind of just think, you don't know that.
Yeah,
and you don't, and I don't, so.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that manifests itself in your career.
Yeah,
I want to talk about music before we stop, because you have a total other career as Riz MC, and you have this group called the Sweatshop Boys, and you are a serious musician as well. And I was watching an early performance of yours on YouTube.
Which one's?
Glastonbury in like 07
okay,
or something.
Wow, yeah, yeah.
And it was
your
so...
Your research is amazing. You're like off the chain with research. I love it.
It's too much.
Incredible.
It's like
Thank
my
you.
Brain explodes.
So kind of you.
But I was watching this, and you finish a track, and all of a sudden you say, you know, I'm not one of those MCs that's into ice and whips and guns and hoes, and I don't have bitches, and I'm not a millionaire, and I don't have bling. And you're saying this to introduce your next song. But it stopped me in my tracks, because... I think of a lot of your lyrics are completely an opportunity to express your unique cultural viewpoint in a medium that your cultural viewpoint isn't often, or it's underrepresented a lot of the time, right? Like, I think about English Dan, I think about how you talk about how you relate the Queen to, and the class system to, like, they've been in the same class since boarding school. And I immediately get that from your perspective, that you're all living on this tiny little island, and yet there's so many different class realities. And I guess watching the evolution of your songwriting, like anything else, the more you do it, the more nuance you can add to it, and the more nuance you can add to it, the more specific you can make it, the more universal it becomes.
Yeah, it's that specific thing. I think that's exactly right. I think it's having the confidence to kind of just be specific to your experience. If I look at my first album, Microscope, that was very much me going like, well, let me like talk about, get things off my chest, or, you know, explain my ideas on like the world.
Right.
And that never resonates as well as kind of just, you know, talking about your specific experience, like mining your own life. That's what, but you assume, again, that it's like, who's going to care about that? Who can relate to it? When I did the English Than mixtape, I actually recorded that in 2013 and didn't release it till 2016 because I just shelved it. I was like, who's going to care about this? Like, what is, like, 10 British Pakistani kids in Bradford are going to be like, oh, that's my life. Like,
that's my jam,
like,
right
no
there.
No one else is going to give a shit.
Yeah.
And it was weird that kind of when things started coming to a head around Brexit, and I saw a kind of a rising xenophobia in this country, which I think is really built on multiculturalism, and it's something that I'm really proud of. I thought, oh shit, I've got that thing, that mixtape I did years ago, and I put it out. And
I think 2012, 2013, that was your time. You know what I mean?
Everything I've got coming out now was made 6 years ago. That's the I've got nothing left. That's the thing. So I put it out, and I think it takes a certain confidence and a maturity to go like, no, I think maybe in the specificity of why I say A, maybe that's valid, and B, even if people can't relate to the specifics, they can really relate to the emotional truth of it. And so I think that's been an evolution, is in embracing the specific and trusting that it can become universal. If I look at like two of the two people I really admire, say, you know, kind of similar age to me, work in TV, and say someone like Donald Glover and someone like Lena Dunham, they really just kind of mine the specificity of their own experiences in creating their TV shows, and they really resonate because people can see it's honest. People just want honesty, right? They want authenticity. Even if you didn't grow up in Atlanta, you didn't grow up, you know, how the characters in Girls did, it somehow resonates because it just feels real. And I'd like to think everyone's journey, including my own, might be like one of being more and more comfortable with being themselves.
Well, it takes an incredible amount of courage to do it. I'm thinking of your song, Sunburst.
Yeah.
Which, there's no other way to say it than it's a song that details the feeling of depression.
Yeah.
And it seems like you can't write like that unless you felt like that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've experienced depression, and I think my brother's actually a psychiatrist, and he tells me that one in three people will experience depression at some point in their life.
There's a lyric of that in the
song.
Yeah.
He should really get writing credit on half of my tracks. He actually jokes about that. So yeah, I often take things to him, and he's like, well, what about this? I think it's something we need to talk about. You know, mental health is something that is really under-resourced in both of our countries. And, you know, I think it's something in particular that we see in the music industry as well, where you have a lot of young kids who kind of like create a kind of viral smash hit EDM track on SoundCloud. Before you know it, booking agents are putting them in front of rooms of like 1,000, 2,000 people. They're like, they're kids, you know, they drink, they start touring heavily. You're in a bar from 6 p.m. for a sound check. You get, you know, before you know it, like people have substance abuse problems and we don't talk about it because they're cash cows until they're burned out. And I just think that, I'm sure everyone would agree that it's like tricky to talk about mental illness or mental health. And I think it's important too, man. Like we, so many of us go through this, so many of us. So if we just talk about it, maybe that'll just make it easier for other people too.
Was that hard to write and think, you know, people are going to read this?
Or? Again, I just assume no one's ever going to hear any of this stuff. It's like that no one's going to see the night of. Ever going to hear English time.
I think your life is changing.
Under the assumption that
there's nothing underground anymore. your life is like getting larger, and your experience is getting, you know, like your reach, I guess. And that must be.
It's hard, but that's hard for that to not kind of poison the purity of you know, your creative process, if you want to be confessional and stuff. So I don't know. I think that's a good way of operating, like assuming that no one's really going to check it out anyway. That's served me well so far. So I think it's a good way of like of carrying on. You know, the reality is, man, like it's hard to get people to the cinema right now. It's hard to get people to want to download your album for free. It's like there's such a glut of content out there that it's attention spans. You know, attention is the new gold dust, really. So I think probably my assumption's truer than even I'd like to think.
I mean, what a great idea that is, right? As an artist, what a great statement that is, that just make work as though no one's ever going to see it and make it as personal as you can and then let the chips fall where they may, right?
Yeah, I hope so. Well, I mean,
except for in the case of Star Wars.
Yeah, except for the other voice in your head that's going like, oh, I want to get a round of applause for this. Like, I hope people think this is cool. Yeah, looking for that Facebook like. I mean, we've all got that duality, haven't we? So.
Yeah. Well, listen, this is fascinating. And I hope everyone sees this conversation because I'm fascinated with the work you're doing. And
thank you, man. Thank you so much for watching all those YouTube videos. I wish I could give you that time back. But thank you. You invoice me for that time.
So you got it.
Exactly.
We'll send you a bill.
Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks for doing it.
Cheers.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with the talented Andrew Garfield.
Treating the film set or rehearsal room and stage like a playground feels like the way to get to the kind of work that I want to be doing. If I don't feel a little frightened and a little terrified of where I may or may not get to in a scene, then I'm probably not doing it right, because I'm not willing for this to be mediocre. I'm not willing for this to be guarded in any way. I want to be totally exposed.
He is the rare actor who seems to have entirely avoided typical early career missteps. From the get-go, he's piled up amazing performances in acclaimed films like The Social Network, Boy A, Never Let Me Go, Hacksaw Ridge, and his latest, Martin Scorsese's Silence. He's one of the most successful artists working today, which has done nothing to calm his sense of perpetual dissatisfaction or the thrill of never knowing exactly what he's going to say or do next. See you next time, off camera.